Bonjour, Anine. Thank you for inviting me this morning. Gnu Danginang Aki, Billy J. Choi Gekas, Nadijanakas, Bijun and Dodem. Gichi Megwich, great thanksgiving to Creator, to this land and all its inhabitants and ancestors in which we are all living and working from. I offer my asema, prayers, honor, and respect to the Aki, the land, the earth, and the First Nations of this land, and specifically all the Nijmaniduag, Two-Spirit medicine elders who sacrifice their lives and carry in their bundles the wisdom, histories, and protocols of creation and their lifeways. I speak from a social location of a queer, non-binary, mixed-race settler originally from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and in adopted relations with my Anishinaabe family, committed to walk alongside them on the Red Road, speaking with settlers and to settler colonial theology in particular. My hope is that what is shared can contribute to unsettling the dominant colonial theological frameworks, worldviews, and practiced beliefs that we all work from and or have been impacted and marginalized by, and promote ways of being that do the work to center justice and resilience for the earth, its more than human members, our kin, and those who live closest to them, our Indigenous siblings, and all other marginalized and oppressed by the hegemony of white supremacy, colonialism and imperialism, and extraction capitalism. This morning, we honor Reconciliation Sunday by creating space in a settler church for the centering of Indigenous teaching in hope that we may continue to learn, embody, and actively practice what is essential in walking alongside our Indigenous siblings. When we hear the term reconciliation, what this involves, the essential steps to reconciliation, are some of the following. One, in order for us to learn and understand, we must first be silent and listen. Listen to the stories, the narratives, and the accounts of those who have died, those who suffer intergenerational trauma, and the teachings of our Indigenous siblings. Another part of reconciliation is to have genuine and an active process of apology. Apology isn't just a one-time event, but it is a continual process. And of course, the essential work of consultation and the asking of permission of how to reconcile with our Indigenous siblings. Audre Lorde, famous Black feminist, womanist writer, wrote an essay where she quotes, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house," which is why we must take lead from our Indigenous siblings, leaders, and elders. Our worldview shaped by colonialism, as well as our context within the Anthropocene, you may have heard this word before, where we are in an earth context where humans are the first species to have had a permanent impact that's irreversible to the earth. But a scholar from Hawaii, Jairus Grove, who I learned from our Indigenous theologian Randy Woodley in the States, uses a more specific term, not just the Anthropocene, but we're in a context of what's called the Europatricene. So it's not just humans, but specifically the worldview that is Eurocentric, patriarchal, and petroleum-based, or an economics that is based on extraction capitalism and unsustainable consumerism. I want to begin by sharing some words as well as statistics that the Reverend Lee Kern, Michi Salgik Nishnabeg of the Anglican Church of Canada, and the Right Relations Coordinator, who also is staff for the Toronto Urban Native Ministries, shares in a homily that is available through the TUNM website that you can all watch. But she gives a description of the most recent visit of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, as well as the Primate Lyndon Nichols, in regards to going around to have conversations with Indigenous communities, which didn't go as well as planned. And what the Reverend Lee Kern expresses is that there is a fuller story to the residential schools that's not being talked about, that is not visible. And these are some of the statistics I want us to quickly go before we start exegeting the text. Your siblings, being the United Church, the Anglicans, we know ran residential schools, Indian day schools, and industrial schools where children did forced labor, slave labor, for over 180 years across Turtle Island. We often hear of 150,000 children attending 139 residential schools. These 139 residential schools were schools that were federal residential schools that were under this agreement, the settlement agreement. But survivors over 1,500 churches, church-run institutions, only 139 were federally funded. This actually means there are 1,300 church-run institutions of confinement of Indigenous children that are not part of this federal settlement agreement. And this is not clearly mentioned, visible, or even aware to the public. This larger list is even more disturbing. So Senator Murray Sinclair, who is the former chair of the TRC, says this optics minimizes the actual truth, where the actual numbers is 1,500 schools and over 1 million children. So it's not just the 139, but there are so many more children and bodies that need to be learned, unburied, and their records, their histories need to be heard. But their stories have been silenced, except for the courage and resentlessness of the survivors of the residential schools. We need to center their voices. The survivors say that empty words, how much was stolen from them, and so little acknowledgement of reparation received is at the center of our problem. We do not understand the severity of this. And of course, this is curated by what is seen through the media, what is spoken. But we need to go to the sources. And who are the sources? Is listening to the accounts of our Indigenous leaders and elders. Survivors have claimed that an apology without reparation is manipulation. We need to listen to how the witnesses and how we can actually respond, the practical steps to responding to the truth, survive the survivors' care within their bodies. That is the residential schools, but there are many different examples that we see across Turtle Island. We see Grassy Narrows and the mercury poisoning, and I encourage everybody to go out in July to continue walking alongside Judy Da Silva to bring more awareness and justice to their community. And then even my community in Manitoba, where Kisikoan and Ojibwe First Nation, where the government of Canada evicted the Anishinaabe people from their lands in Riding Mountain National Park in 1936 for the purposes of preservation, conservation, but settler recreation, being Riding Mountain being a national park that draws tourism. And with this eviction, they forbade any of the community to use all the plant medicines for over 60 years. Luckily, my elder Audrey Brown says that there was an apology and return to the land, and a promise to never take their lands away again, except that currently there is a land back protest happening where Riding Mountain National Park has closed some of its roads, making barriers for the Indigenous community, including my elder Audrey, to get access to medicines to serve the wider community. The king's passage that we read today has a familiar tone. We have the Israelites forsaking their covenants, destroying sacred places and ceremonies, and even killing their prophets. So without going into the homiletical fallacy of proof texting the scriptures to make a point, what I want to do is I would like to exegete the gospel for us, and I want to leave with you what you might hear, what the Holy Spirit might be stirring up inside you when we look and place ourselves as settlers in the shoes of, let's say, the man who is possessed with demons. It's a very interesting text that was given for this Sunday. We don't talk a lot about demons. We don't talk a lot about the spirit, except in indigenous communities where Gitche Manadu, or the Manadus, the great spirit, is part of their embodied reality. And I think there's a lot we can learn from listening to these teachings or the way these narratives are shaped. So, what did the Gospel of Luke account? This man who had demons, plural, lived inside the tombs. Who are inside the tombs? What narratives still reside under the ground and in the graves? Even once, Jesus calls the Pharisees, the religious people, white-walled sepulchers, being nice and clean outside but dead inside. This man was kept under guard, bound by chains and shackles. If we were to put ourselves in the shoes of imprisonment or captivity, what does that mean? How have our imaginations, our worldviews been captured by the realities of colonialism, the economy of the day, the Anthropocene or the Europatricene? And then we have this interesting script, the man, or I should say legion, yells out to Jesus, "What have you to do with me, I beg?" When you hear, and especially as settlers, when we hear the accounts of the history of this land and how we do participate as beneficiaries because of our privileges, what's stirring up inside of us? In the Greek, the word beg, deomai, means binding oneself. How are we bound? How are we trapped in our imaginations, in our consciousness, that dictate how we act and live and relate to one another? Legion says then, "You do not torment me." Do not torment me. Basanizo, which means torture, pain, torment, loss. We have this circle of violence, embodied violence in the histories of our indigenous siblings, but what kind of binding and violence is happening in our settler consciousness that we might not be actually aware of? And then Jesus asked, "What is your name?" What are the names of the lost souls from the residential schools? Because name has power. The word, or the logos, this speaking out of the right ordering of creation, has power to transform and even resurrect, like in the story of Jesus calling Lazarus' name to come out. It is essential and urgent that we speak the names of those who have been murdered. And then Legion begs Jesus not to send them out. There's this resistance. Please, no. What are the resistances that we hold in our bodies when we hear of stories, when we are called to be accountable for our relations, specifically as settlers? And then we have this Jesus coming to exorcise the demons out of Legion. And this is so interesting because what ends up happening, and I don't know what you feel about this passage, but we have the demons go into pigs, and then they run off the cliff into the lake. Even when we, let's say, exorcise or release making captive our motivations, our mind, our consciousness, The acts have been done, and there are still impacts on creation. And this text is saying still the pigs are affected, and the lake and the waterways, water being a source of life, is polluted. There is still a consequence to the action that we do. And of course, all the people of the land was gripped with fear. And then Jesus had to leave. I won't interpret this exegesis of this passage. I want you to hear the words. I want you to hear how we participate even in this narrative. Kira Lander says, both indigenous nations and the settler state will need to come in terms with what it means to have multiple nations occupying the same space. We will need to find a way to live together in a mutually respectful, mutually agreeable, and mutually beneficial way on indigenous lands. We live on indigenous lands. We will need to find a way to govern ourselves in this new reality of Mino Bimatsuin, living the way of the good life, Mino Wichtawin, living together with trust and respect, and Waktawin, this idea of kinship, the web of relationships we are all tethered to one another. With all of these teachings, while also finding new ways of working and living together without convergence, because they are different paths. How are we walking alongside each other? Figuring this out requires a meaningful reconciliation with each nation, as well as between nations. Leanne Betasamokse Simpson, Michi Sagignishnabeg, says, none of this had to happen. None of this was inevitable. Colonialism was and is a choice Canadians and all settlers make every day. It is a choice to maintain and to uphold a system that is based on hyper-exploitation of the land and Indigenous peoples. It is a choice to maintain a system that overwhelmingly promotes greed over creation. There are broken relationships between humans, First Nations, and settlers, and more than human earth community siblings. All members live alongside each other and with an interrelated ecosystem, and yet it is the ignorance, denial, apathy, and abusive natures of the dominant settler colonial culture that continues to acquire privilege and power at the expense of the earth and its First Nations. These relationships need to be reconciled, and a new way of being must be cultivated that is life-giving for all members of creation. Humans are accountable to one another and to the land they live upon, which is the literal grounding of our context. Even with the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Christian communities, there is still a huge void in the minds and hearts of settler Christians to pursue authentic and just relationships with their cohabitating Indigenous neighbors and Earth's life systems. A primary reason for the lack of implementing these initiatives in specifically theological work that in turn impacts ecclesial and cultural norms within Christianity is because the normative theological methods that frame these theological relations work from a colonial paradigm which is not compatible and are oppressive to indigenous worldviews and teachings. Christianity and the colonialism that has shaped its theology is relationally accountable to the harm it has inflicted upon the earth and its indigenous peoples. Because of the contextual needs of our time regarding decolonization and navigating environmental destruction, something I propose is a theology of relational accountability that focuses on an ecocentric and anti-colonial method, which is needed to be considered in implementing all of our theology and all of our ethical disciplines. This theology of relational accountability must embody an ecocentric and anti-colonial ways of being, which teach that all things are interrelated and each member of this relationship is always accountable to one another. We see this in the core, and I'll end with this, our core Christology of how we understand the Christ, where Christ embodied this practice of reconciliation, literally in their body, through the death, the traveling down into the hell realms, literally transforming the poison of violence, suffering, evil, into medicine of resurrection. And if Paul says Christ is the firstborn of all of creation, and that we are crucified with Christ, and it's no longer we who live, but Christ who lives in us, we have access to this powerful medicine in the resurrection of Jesus. How do we apply this to our everyday lives? Sunday school answer, Jesus. But when it comes to partnering with how, what does it mean to walk alongside our Indigenous siblings, we must listen to them. So I will end with a quote on reconciliation by John Burroughs, Anishinaabe Chippewa of the Nawash First Nation. John Burroughs says, "Reconciliation between Indigenous peoples and the Crown settlers requires our collective reconciliation with the earth. Practices and partnerships of resurgence and reconciliation must sustain the living earth and are more than human relatives for future generations," thinking about the next seven generations that follow us. "This will not occur without the simultaneous resurgence of Indigenous laws, governments, economies, education, relations to the living earth, ways of knowing and being, and keeping treaty relationships." Amen.